Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Richard Russo, who reads from and discusses his new book, Bridge of Sighs, published by Knopf. In the weeks to come, we have Mary Carwile and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. Of his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Empire Falls, the Christian Science Monitor had this to say, quote, "The history of American literature may show that Richard Russo wrote the last great novel of the 20th century," unquote. 6 years and that Pulitzer Prize later, Richard is back with his newest novel, Bridge of Sighs, perhaps his most complex work to date. And it proves once again that nobody can write about America, about class, and about people in small towns quite like Richard Russo. After receiving his PhD in American Lit and a master's in creative writing, he went on to teach creative writing, most recently at Colby College in Maine. But with the success of Nobody's Fool, he was able to retire and devote himself entirely to writing full time. In addition to writing such amazing novels as Mohawk, The Risk Pool, Straight Man, Nobody's Fool, and The Horse Child and other stories, Richard is also a screenwriter. In fact, his screenplay for Nobody's Fool earned him an Oscar nomination. His most recent projects with film include The Ice Harvest and Keeping Mum. Please welcome Richard Russo.
Can everybody hear okay? Yeah? Well, I do have to correct one thing in all honesty. Much as I would love to accept the Oscar nomination for Nobody's Fool, the screenplay was written by Robert Benton, who's a good friend of mine, and it might get back to him, actually, if I if I accepted that nomination on his behalf. And so I will correct that one small point, although I did do a lot of work on that script. It's wonderful to be back here at the Tattered Cover. This is truly one of the great bookstores in America, and it's an honor to be welcomed back. I'm very glad to be here. I know I have at least a couple of friends in the audience who suspect that I do, and looking forward to saying hello afterwards and to answer any questions that you have. I'm in my third week of book tour now, and as you can probably tell, I'm beginning to leak brain cells, but I will try to answer a few questions if you have them at the end, and of course be happy to sign books as well. Thank you all for coming tonight. The section that I'm going to read tonight occurs about 150 pages into the book, and it's not going to take an enormous amount of time to read, probably 15, 20 minutes. It does, however, require about 15 minutes of setup, not quite that much, about 5 minutes of setup. So I do have to spend about 5 or 7 minutes just telling you some things in the story that will help keep you from being totally lost when I start to actually read from the text. The character that we're going to follow in this section, his name is Robert Noonan. He has just turned 60 when the novel opens. He is a painter living as an expatriate in Venice now, although he has really been living all over Europe for the last, since he was 18 years old when he fled his upstate New York hometown of Thomaston. During that time, he has been drinking and brawling his way across Europe. He has been married several times and divorced several times, and he's at this point through with marriage, but not through with married women. At this point, he's going to be he's contemplating, and his agent is has set up his first show in New York in decades. He hasn't been back to New York City or New York State, and he's got a show coming up in a couple of months. He's putting the last touches on. Some of his final paintings here, and he's absolutely dreading it. and trying to think of any ways that he might avoid actually doing this. At 60, he has a few health problems, and they are deeply mysterious to him. They've all begun to show up in just the last couple of years. And the first of these is that he has been visited recently by night terrors. He will awake in the middle of the night, absolutely alive with rage and fear, and he has no idea what he's afraid of, or no idea what he might be what he might be angry about. Luckily, only one person has witnessed one of these night terrors, but they so unnerve him that he has taken of late to painting at night and sleeping in the day. That doesn't seem to happen to him when he sleeps in the day. So he's taken to painting at night, and then walking the streets of Venice when he can't paint anymore until the sun comes up. Even more mysteriously, he's being visited by grief. And he has no idea what he's sorry about, but at times he will just be overcome. Sometimes in very public places, he will just be overcome by grief and begin to weep uncontrollably. Rather embarrassing, as you can imagine. And the last time that that's happened to him, he's actually had to duck into a church because he saw someone that he knew coming up the street who's just hailed him. But he has ducked into a church to avoid being seen in this unfortunate state. The married woman that he is involved with right now is named Evangeline Lichtner. You will meet her in this scene briefly. You will also meet her husband, her husband is Todd Lichtner. He is a kind of failed novelist and now travel writer, and he's out of town a lot, which is good for them. Out of town at the moment, as a matter of fact. And as far as Evangeline is concerned, she's told Noonan that her husband doesn't have clue one about what's going on between them. There's also a reference to Hugh Morgan, who is the owner of the gallery that Noonan will show his work in New York. But he's also a lifelong friend of Noonan's. They fled America and Vietnam at the same time. And Hugh owns several galleries elsewhere in Europe. The other main character in this novel, whom we're not going to meet in this section, his name is Lucy Lynch. His name is Lou C. Lynch, and he's been tagged with that nickname, unfortunately, since kindergarten. He and Noonan share a couple of things in common, one of which is that when they were boys and friends, both of their fathers were root men. Lucy's father was a milkman, and Noonan's father was a mailman. The principal difference between them is that Lucy absolutely adored his father, and even at age 60 cannot bear to hear a word against him, whereas Noonan absolutely loathed his father and is one of the reasons that he fled his hometown when he did. And one last thing. Within the last month or so, Noonan has just begun a new painting. Wasn't really his intention to paint it, but he decided to anyway for, again, reasons that are kind of mysterious to him. But he's begun a new painting of his father, the bully, the ogre of his childhood. But a strange thing has happened. 3 or 4 weeks into the painting, he has looked at it one day and discovered that it's really his own eyes staring back at him out of his father's portrait. And even stranger, when other people who know him come in and have seen the portrait now almost completed, every one of them has recognized it as a self-portrait. That's all you need to know and more. Okay. "Hey," Evangeline said. She was poking Noonan as one would a dangerous animal that looked dead but might not be. Fully dressed and standing next to the bed, she was clearly prepared to run should the need arise. "Talk to me, Noonan." "What about?" he said, groggily, rising up on an elbow. At the sound of his voice, modulated and sane, Evangeline visibly relaxed. Flight would not be necessary after all. So far, she was the only person to witness one of his night terrors. This was now over a month ago, but the experience was still fresh in her mind. Half an hour after falling asleep, he'd awakened in a paroxysm of rage. And when she made the mistake of trying to calm him down, he'd lashed out, not even recognizing her, really, and punched her in the face hard. The resulting black eye had been hard to explain to her husband. And since then, they had agreed not to risk a repetition. They continued their sporadic, desultory sex. But when it was over, either she or Noonan went home before post-coital sleepiness could descend. The last thing that she had done tonight before drifting off was ask him if he felt sleepy. He'd said no, thinking that he would be able to stay awake, but then fell asleep anyway. "I suppose," she said, "you could tell me what you're sorry about." "I was talking in my sleep," he said. She sat on the edge of the bed now, holding the back of her hand gently to his cheek. "You kept saying how sorry you were," she said. "It didn't sound like you at all." "Didn't sound like my voice," he said. "No, it was your voice, all right. Just not the sort of thing that normally comes out of your mouth, if you know what I mean. Sort of like Hugh Morgan saying, 'I don't know.' Anyway, I accept your apology, even if it was meant for somebody else." Noonan swung his feet out of bed. "I gather you're leaving," he said. "It's almost midnight." "Well, if you can wait till I put my pants on, I'll walk you home," he said. "We really shouldn't be seen together," Evangeline said, but he could tell that this objection was his to override. As it turned out, they had both the Vaporetto and the streets to themselves. Even San Marco was deserted, except for the last of the musicians putting away their instruments outside Cafe Florian, and some waiters stacking chairs on a gurney. "So when does Todd get back?" he asked, when they arrived at Campo San Stefano, off of which her gallery was located, their living quarters above. "Tomorrow," she said. A failed novelist turned travel writer, Todd Lichtner was often away on assignment for one of a half dozen magazines. "Speaking of which," she said, "will you see Hugh again?" "It's possible," Noonan said. "I got the impression he wasn't finished badgering me." "Well, remind him that he promised to stop by my gallery." "If he promised," Noonan said, "he won't need to be reminded." "But I have one or two pieces I'd really like him to see," she said. "The Ponte?" Newman said. She nodded. "And Gene Nugent's new work." Noonan shrugged. "The Ponte's good. Hugh might like it." "Probably not, though." And he couldn't think of a single reason for Hugh or anyone else to like the Nugent. Evangeline must have read his mind and perhaps even shared his assessment, because when she looked away, there was just enough light from the nearby street lamp to see that her eyes were moist. "I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to stay open," she said, her voice full of terrible resignation. "Some days, I can't even remember why I want to. Most of what I do anymore is just habit, starting with getting out of bed in the morning." Getting into bed with him was another example, clearly. No need even to state this. "People get into ruts," Noonan said. And he thought, ruts weren't always a bad thing. Maybe an artist's discipline, process and routine, habit, if you will, maybe they were just ruts with a purpose. And if you were talented and lucky, they paid off in a kind of freedom, at least within the borders of canvas. Counterintuitive, granted, but there you were. The danger was that the purpose of your regimen would be lost, leaving mere habit to explain and justify itself if it could. And when it couldn't, well, maybe you were done. Going through the motions, those motions of feeble prayer, that was unanswered and unanswerable. Why had he become a nocturnal walker, taking the same route night after night through the streets of Venice, all five Sestieri, San Marco, Castello, Canareggio, San Paolo, Dossoduro. Always in that order, never the reverse. Gauging time by space and vice versa. In the end, how different was he from his father, whose strict discipline had never been rooted in anything more profound than the selfish need to be in control? I do love Venice, Evangeline continued, but it's absurd living here. Where would you go? Noonan said. Yes, well, there you are. What does your husband want? Wouldn't it be nice to know, she said. If I could figure that out, I could want the opposite. Try changing something small, Noonan suggested, something that doesn't matter. See how that feels. I've been thinking about doing that, actually, she said. The small thing I've been thinking about changing is you. If you're trying to hurt my feelings, Noonan said. I'm not, she said, tears really starting to flow now. I'm really not. I mean, did you enjoy it tonight? Us? Did it speak to you in any way? The question was fair enough. The exhausted orgasm he had finally achieved, while pleasurable enough, had seemed remote. Something happening on a parallel track. Vibrations half absorbed by the ground, no danger of collision. Was it just age? The law of diminishing emotional returns played out in the flesh? I'm glad you came over, he said, which was true. Though it was also true that he was now just as happy to return her to her husband and her life. You want to hear something crazy, she said? I guess. She wiped her eyes on her sleeve, smudging it with eyeshadow. Here is what I seem to want from you, Noonan. I want to not see you again for a long while. That's the first thing. The second is, if Hugh comes by tomorrow, I'd like you to come with him. I think, Noonan said, you just summed up about 40 years' worth of my relationships with women. It's not a new ambivalence. It's just new to you. You want to come up, she said. Now? Christ, no, he said. And then she was gone, the slamming door echoing out into the canal. He said her name and then tried the door, but it had locked behind her. Lucky that, for he might have been tempted to follow her inside. He lingered there a moment in the doorway, then stepped back a few paces to the water's edge and looked up, waiting for a light to come on inside, which eventually it did, reflecting off the shimmering water and the dark brick walls that framed the canal. A painting, Noonan recognized, and also a memory. A moment later, Evangeline appeared at the window, reaching outside to pull the shutters closed. He didn't think she saw him standing down there in the shadows below. But then her voice came down, barely audible. Go home, Noonan. With the shutters closed, the canal was dark again, and the painting was gone. He had just rounded the corner and started to descend the three steps into the narrow calle that opened into Campo San Stefano when something hit him in the chest hard. Before he could make sense of that, there was the inexplicable sound of coins dancing on the streets on the stones at his feet. Todd Lichtner's pale face momentarily swam into view, and when Noonan blinked, was gone again. Noonan stepped back, rubbing his breastbone, the pain there, the only thing that he could be certain was real. And then he saw the other man again, gathering up the scattered coins as best he could in the dark and muttering, "What a rotten bastard you are, Noonan." It seemed not to occur to Lichtner that a truly rotten bastard might just kick him in the head as he scrabbled around on his knees, and Noonan might have done just that if he hadn't been so puzzled by the coins. The punch and the simultaneous explosion of coins illogically suggested that his chest had been full of them, freed by the blow, like candy from a piñata. He would have preferred another explanation, but when he tried to form a question, he discovered that he had no breath, that Lichtner had hit him harder and with more conviction than Noonan would have dreamed the other man possessed. It was all deeply puzzling. So he sat down on the step to watch Lichtner grope around in the dark for the coins that he seemed to think belonged to him. One had come to rest between Noonan's feet, and he picked it up to examine it. Poor light. But he could have sworn it was an American quarter. Finally, Lichtner got to his feet and came over to glare down at him with a mixture of anger and, unless Noonan was mistaken, dawning embarrassment. Evangeline had apparently been wrong about at least one thing. Her husband did have clue one. Noonan handed him the quarter, which he promptly threw in the canal. "You shitheel," Lichtner said, still shaking, though his pique seemed to wane as his embarrassment waxed. Noonan's breathing was returning, and with it an idea. Lichtner must have had a roll of coins in his fist to heighten the impact, but the blow had ruptured it. And, with that realization, the world, which had momentarily tilted, righted itself. "You're home early," he said. His voice little more than a croak. "Since yesterday," Lichtner said. "I've been staying in a goddamn hotel, in case you're interested." "Where were you before that?" Noonan said. "Las Vegas." Noonan smiled, the roll of coins making sense now. Lichtner had been playing the quarter slots. How perfectly, Lichtner. "I knew there was somebody," he said. "I knew it." He was still standing over Noonan, his fists clenched. "If you punch me again," Noonan said, "I'm going to throw you in the canal." Lichtner took an abrupt step back. "Hey," he said, "I'm the one with the grievance here." "Nevertheless," Noonan said, still massaging his breastbone, "fair warning." To Lichtner, Noonan's resolve not to be punched a second time seemed to limit the proceedings unfairly. Still, there could be little doubt that Noonan intended to carry out his threat, so Lichtner shrugged and said, "You all right?" "I guess," Noonan said, though he wasn't sure and remained seated for the moment. His breathing was returning to normal, but it felt like the other man's fist was still inside of his chest cavity, heaving and flexing. "That hurt, if it makes you feel any better," he said. "Good," Lichtner said, offering him his hand. "I'm glad." Noonan allowed himself to be pulled to his feet. "What now?" he said. Lichtner shrugged again, fully embarrassed now. "I don't know," he admitted. "This didn't go the way I imagined. I guess I didn't think much past punching you in the face." "You punched me in the chest." "You were standing on a step," Lichtner explained. "My timing was off. I guess I was impatient." Noonan went over to the water's edge, raised some phlegm, and spat it into the canal. "I suppose we could go someplace and talk about it," Lichtner said, his hands down at his sides now. "The bars over in Campo Santa Margarita might still be open." "That's all students over there," Noonan reminded him. "Kids." "What the hell," Lichtner said. "We're behaving like children. We might as well drink with them." He actually seemed disappointed that Noonan wasn't more enthusiastic about the idea. "I probably shouldn't go home," Lichtner added. "Not until I've calmed down." To Noonan, the other man looked like he had calmed down and then some. He looked more like a man afraid of getting punched by his wife than he was of punching her. He seemed to comprehend utterly that he was good for about one punch a decade, and he had thrown it not 2 minutes ago. "Thought you were staying in a hotel," Noonan said. "Just the 2 nights," Lichtner explained. "If I didn't find out who it was tonight, I was just going to ask her." The bar they found over at Campo Santa Margarita was, as Noonan predicted, full of university students. Several of them, recognizable by their outlandish costumes, were celebrating the completion of their final exams. Lichtner and Noonan took a table as far away from the students as possible, though it wasn't far enough. "Dottore! Dottore!" they chanted, while a boy dressed as a penis chugged from a pitcher. Noonan ordered a beer, Lichtner a Campari. By the time the drinks came, some of the latter's indignation had returned. I knew it had to be you, he said. I just knew it. How? Noonan wondered, curious about the other man's logic. Evangeline, he happened to know, it had several lovers before himself. How had they been ruled out? You're the only man I know who would punch a woman, Lichtner said. That's repellent. I can't forgive that, he added, in case Noonan asked him to. It was an accident, actually, Noonan said. Ask her if you don't believe me. Clearly, Lichtner did, though his resentment was such that he couldn't admit to it. How about fucking her, he said. I suppose that was an accident, too? Well, there was an accidental quality to the whole thing, Noonan said, now that you mention it. It's probably over, if that's any interest. It isn't, Lichtner said petulantly. It isn't of interest, and it isn't over. Not for me. I'm the one who has to imagine the two of you going at it. How can I stay here in Venice knowing what I know? Noonan was tempted to tell him that he was just being silly. If it wasn't him in Venice, it'd be another man in Paris or London or Davenport, Iowa. Lichtner's problem, or one of them, was that his wife was unhappy. A condition that, if not universal, was nearly so. She wanted more. More than Todd Lichtner, for one. More than Noonan, for another. Who the hell didn't? Maybe you should divorce, Noonan suggested. Lichtner polished off his Campari with a sneer. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Actually, Noonan said, summoning as much sincerity as he could, I don't care one way or the other. Leave or stay, divorce or stay married. Do what makes you least miserable. I never said I was miserable, Lichtner replied, his back up now. Oh, I'm sorry, Noonan said. I thought you did. Maybe right this second, Lichtner conceded miserably. But even I have weathered worse than you, far worse. You aren't going to tell me about it, I hope, Noonan said. And it's not like I've been 100% faithful to her, he added proudly. What percentage would you estimate? Noonan said. Lichtner ignored this. I've never screwed the wife of a friend, though, he said. That's where I draw the line. We're friends, you and I? Noonan said. We're not? The other man said. It was amazing to watch a man so all over the emotional map. Each new feeling at war with the preceding as well as the subsequent. Each important without being satisfying, sustainable, or for that matter, even reliable. Noonan couldn't be sure whether he was observing a person or a condition common to men their age. Well, it hadn't occurred to me, I guess, Noonan said. Not that it would have mattered. That day in the church, you broke my heart, Noonan. I felt really close to you then. How close were you? Noonan said. How many pews? Lichtner shrugged, looking pitiful. Hey, you don't want to be friends? Nobody's forcing you, he said. When the waiter came by, Noonan shook his head. A second drink would merely reinforce Lichtner's notion that they were friends, something Noonan was determined to avoid. The other man took out some money. Sorry I punched you, he said. Me too, Noonan said. It still felt like the other man's fist was trapped in his chest. You're sorry you screwed my wife, or you're sorry I punched you, Lichtner said. Just sorry, Noonan thought. No more able to pin it down now than he had been earlier with Evangeline. Did you get credit for being sorry if you couldn't explain what you were sorry about? Noonan had spent enough time in catechism as a kid to doubt it. There you learn to diagram sins like sentences. And unless you could explain what you had done wrong and why, forgiveness was withheld. The students were still chanting when Lichtner and Noonan rose to leave. Dottore! Dottore! They shouted, fuck yourself, fuck yourself! A girl dressed like a wood nymph chugged from her flagon of beer and then set it down triumphantly. Nearby, the penis who had been chugging when they entered was now slumped forward in his chair, flaccid. Outside in the campo, Lichtner looked like he might cry. I can't go home, he said. Sure you can, Noonan said. He'd gone out for a drink with a man who had just bushwhacked him because it seemed like the decent thing to do, but enough was enough. Just don't punch Evangeline, he said, because then you will be sorry. That much I can pretty much guarantee. The thing is, Lichtner said, not even supposed to be here in Venice. My plane doesn't land until tomorrow morning. How about letting me crash on your sofa? It's really the least you could do if you think about it. Noonan did think about it and arrived at the opposite conclusion. Still, how come you don't have a suitcase, he said. It's in a locker over at the Ferrovia, Lichtner explained. All right, go get it if you want, Noonan said. I'll leave the door unlocked. Yeah, right, Lichtner said. Like I can trust you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Mary Carwile and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 22nd, 2007.